Well, again, good afternoon. I would like to invite you to take your Bibles, turn along with me to the Gospel of Luke in chapter 6. Luke chapter 6, we're going to be reading there together in just a moment. Again, we want to continue to extend our welcome to those who are with us. As was just mentioned in the prayer, we have so many to be mindful of who can't join us. And as we often do, we want to take notice as a family here of those who are not able to join us tonight and see what we can perhaps do to provide some encouragement and build the faith of others who may need that. We're going to be continuing on, but we want to remind ourselves just a little bit of where we are in the text, what we've seen, and how that's going to affect what we read in the Scripture tonight. Luke chapter 5 contains more interaction with Jesus and the crowds. He's continuing to teach them. He's continuing to provide miracles. And as a result, the attention that the crowds are giving him, well, that just keeps on increasing. So the numbers are becoming increasingly large. Chapter 5 specifically focused, though, on the time that Jesus spent with the penitent sinners and the tax collectors. Those who knew of their sick condition and sin and were seeking him out as the great physician. And so chapter 5, we've mentioned the conflict that's already starting to begin between the Pharisees who don't like the attention that Jesus is getting, but chapter 5 really boils that up to the next level. As not only are they jealous of the attention that Jesus is receiving, but they are judging him wrongly, they're judging him unrighteously, for who he is spending his time with. And so chapter 6, it's not strictly chronological that one happens immediately after the other, but these events, specifically the first two that we're going to look at, are presented in such a way that Jesus comes into conflict with the Pharisees immediately after having those discussions with the very harsh words where he openly reprimands them for refusing to accept the new and needed teaching that Jesus is bringing. Now, we're about to read the text, but I thought it would be good for us to provide a disclaimer on what we're going to read. When we think about the story of Jesus, when we think about the Gospels, who do we view as the bad guys? Who are the villains in the story? Well, they're the Pharisees, right? You know, those are the bad guys. And that's not wrong. But what that often does is it puts them on this side, and then we're over here on this side, and we're just reading about them saying, oh, those bad Pharisees, look what they did in this text, and now they're up to it again. And that doesn't provide us with any introspection in our own lives. The example of the Pharisees are not just left there for us to point at them. They are also left there for us to use it as an honest time to reflect and see, am I making the same mistakes that they are? And I'm not throwing that around in the way that sometimes people today will wrongly and casually accuse someone of being Pharisaical. I mean that when we read these texts, yes, we need to view them in their proper light, but we also read it from the perspective of, can I make the same mistakes that these people who had perhaps good intentions found themselves making as well? So let's go ahead and begin in Luke chapter 6 and starting in verse 1. Now it came about that on a certain Sabbath he was passing through some grain fields, and his disciples were picking and eating the heads of wheat, rubbing them in their hands. But some of the Pharisees said, why do you do what is not lawful on the Sabbath? And Jesus, answering them, said, have you not even read what David did when he was hungry, he and those who were with him? How he entered the house of God and took and ate the consecrated bread, which is not lawful for any to eat, except the priests alone, and gave it to his companions. And he was saying to them, the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. So, as Jesus is passing through, he and his disciples are doing something that wasn't all that uncommon. In fact, this was something that was prepared for in the law in Deuteronomy chapter 23, as it would speak about, as you pass through the countryside, you had the right to take a little bit off of the edges of your neighbor's field or whoever's field, as long as you weren't actually stealing. And so the Pharisees were not mad at Jesus and his disciples strictly because they are taking grain from this field. Of course, the text specifies that what upsets them so much is that this is on the Sabbath. We have spoken in other contexts about the Pharisees' unique level of zeal from protecting the law. And it rose to the level of not just ensuring and encouraging that others were observing it, but putting on additional layers of protection to keep people from even getting close. And so, for example, we have passages like Exodus chapter 23 and verse 19, which somewhat obscurely warns against boiling a goat in its mother's milk. And so the Pharisees, and still to this day, Jews, to keep that from ever happening, will not serve dairy and meat at the same meal. And that way you don't have to worry about that ever having happened. And so as they look through the disciples going through the field and they're picking it up, what they see in their minds, not actually, but in their minds, are just all sorts of violations of the law. From them picking it, well, that was equated to gleaning. From them crushing it in their hands, well, that was grinding it. Well, when they disposed of the chaff that was in their hand, that was the same as winnowing. And the fact that they were eating something showed that they had prepared food on that day. And so I like the way that one commentator puts it. They had four violations of the Sabbath in just one mouthful. And so the Pharisees look at this and they are livid. Now again, we have to sort of step aside. We know that these were not actual violations of the law. But to the Pharisees who had so encumbered the law with these traditions, well, the disciples are just flagrantly violating the law and the traditions of their fathers. I think before we proceed in our text with Jesus' response, this is perhaps the first good place for us to pause and take to heart if we need to avoid something that the Pharisees were doing here. Again, we've said in other contexts that the Pharisees are never condemned because they just followed God's law too closely, that they were too careful. What they were rebuked for were primarily two things: the portions of the law that they had neglected, and when they had elevated their own traditions in a status equal to or above the law of God. God was furious when Israel did not keep the Sabbath. But it was no more pleasing to God when people were technically keeping the Sabbath, but they had perverted its use by applying their own laws and customs over and above why God had instituted the Sabbath. You know, the desire to preserve faithfulness and to avoid presuming on the will of God, that is a good thing. But I need to see that it was equally presumptuous for me to think that God is going to be pleased when I put extra barriers or extra commands on top of what he has already put in place. Now, we'll talk about more on that in a moment, but let's return to the context of our passage. When Jesus responds, he does so by referring them back to an event that is recorded in 1 Samuel chapter 21. This is when David has just gotten on the run from Saul. And, as is often the case in those situations, there are no preparations that are made. And so, stopping in, he comes into contact with the priest, and he wants to know what is on hand, what could he possibly have. Well, Ahimelech the priest says, "All I have is the consecrated bread, and that's not lawful for you to eat." But in his mind, he was making allowances. He made sure that the people that were with David were not unclean, and he gave them of the bread and what he considered to be an emergency situation. Now, there are two other gospel accounts that add a little bit more detail to Jesus' conversation, and I think that those are helpful to look at for extra study. But for Luke's account, the basic message that he conveys is, here is a well-known story about David, And as teachers of the law, they should have been familiar with it, and they should have been familiar with some of the applications from it. David clearly violated the law. And, as we've seen recently, David had consequences for violating the law. But God, in His grace and mercy, allowed David to continue. Here is an example where people are not violating the law at all. They're fine with David being shown mercy, who did break the law, but their hatred for Jesus and His disciples is so great and so intense that they're not willing to extend any mercy to these 12 followers of the Lord or whoever else was there, and they haven't done anything at all. Jesus is primarily pointing out their hypocrisy. But there's a second and perhaps even more powerful point that Jesus makes that emphasizes that He's not in the wrong. It comes with Him declaring Himself to be Lord of the Sabbath. Now, I want to emphasize that this is not Jesus saying, well, I'm in charge, I make the rules, and I can do what I want to. It's my Sabbath, and I'll observe it however I feel like. That's not what Jesus is saying. Declaring the Son of Man to be Lord of the Sabbath is akin to saying, look, I made this. I created this. I know how it functions. I know when someone is keeping it, and I know when someone is breaking it. If anyone is going to know if someone's in violation of the Sabbath, surely it would be the Lord of the Sabbath. Jesus was not going to guide His disciples down a path that was going to cause them to enter into sin. Jesus knew that He and His disciples were not in violation, and so this story of David is offered up as a well-known example to prove that point. I think it's also worth noting, though, what Jesus is claiming in this section. What this is an outright claim to divinity. While there have been other occasions where Jesus has and will tell people, don't tell who I am, this is not one of them. The Sabbath was a divine institution, and no man could proclaim himself to be Lord over it. And so when Jesus says that the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath, that is a clear-cut claim to divinity. Well, there's another example that Luke stacks right on top of this one. And let's get back to the text and see that as we continue. In verse 6, and it came about on another Sabbath that He entered the synagogue and was teaching. And there was a man there whose right hand was withered. And the scribes and the Pharisees were watching Him closely to see if He healed on the Sabbath in order that they might find reason to accuse Him. But He knew what they were thinking. And He said to the man with the withered hand, arise and come forward. And he arose and came forward. And Jesus said to them, I ask you, is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do evil, to save a life or to destroy it? And after looking around at them all, He said to him, stretch out your hand. And he did so. And his hand was completely restored. But they themselves were filled with rage and discussed together what they might do to Jesus. Now the text doesn't tell us how much time passed between these two events, but Luke portrays them for us or records them for us to link and make a very vivid picture of what Jesus was facing. The type of opposition and the absolute hard-heartedness that was present in His audience. The text tells us that they were looking at Jesus. The idea is like a predator who is sort of silently lurking off in the corner, just waiting for prey to come by so it can leap out and snatch it. Now that's a vicious image in and of itself. But think about that in the context of what we're reading here. They knew that here's a man who is sick. Here's a man who has a problem. and here's a man who can do something about it. That sounds like good news. That sounds like a wonderful situation, and yet their response to it is not glorifying God and rejoicing at what's come to His people. It's, let's look for a way to use this and turn this into a trap. Maybe He will do good. And then we'll have cause, we'll find grounds that we can accuse Him. Of course, Jesus is all too aware of the situation. They're not going to catch the Lord by surprise. And the question that He poses is intended to reveal their hearts. And so He makes sure to bring this man into a position where everyone would see what was happening. He's brought him front and center stage. And again, we might take note of the absolute language that Jesus uses in speaking to the Pharisees. Either this is wrong or it's right. Either this is lawful or it's unlawful. Now you tell me, which one is it? There isn't a middle ground. I think what Jesus is doing here is at least showing some measure of patience with the Pharisees. He's asking this question and giving them an opportunity to respond and maybe allowing that question to sink in and have that shake the head, wake up call moment. What are we doing here? Why are we looking to trap this man when he is so clearly sent from God, and look at the good that he is doing? But of course, that moment does not come. And even though, of course, they had some sort of thought on the matter, they're not willing to express it. I think you can get this intention in the text when it says that Jesus looked at each one of them. But Mark 3 especially spells it out. Jesus was filled with grief, but he was also filled with anger over the hardness of their hearts. And so before the healing takes place, that contact is made with each one who is there, almost as if to communicate, I want you to think about what you're doing. I want you to think about what you've done and where your hearts are at. So he commands the man to stretch out his hand, and it's healed. Now again, the obvious response to that would be, glorify God. He is visiting His people. He is bringing about healing and times of refreshing. This is wonderful news. This is what we've been waiting for. And yet, the text puts on display the terrible hardness of their hearts. They're not moved by it at all. It only deepens their resolve to find some way to trap Jesus and to use something against Him in the future. Some observations on this text in general. At the heart of this conflict, we have a battle of two wills. We have what God has commanded to do, and then we have what some men wish to do. Now, a heart that was open would have been listening to Jesus, glad to make changes and move toward repenting. But the Pharisees were determined to harden their hearts to the truth. So even in the face of what we can only call irrefutable evidence that this man is from God, nope, we're not going to budge. We know right from wrong. We know that you're doing the right thing, but you're a threat. We don't like it, and we will not be moved. You know, we think about passages like this later on when we get deeper into Luke, and the story of the rich man and Lazarus, and Abraham's words of refusal to send someone to this man's brothers. If anyone thinks that those are callous and cold-hearted, remembering passages like this reveals that they're not. There was no amount of proof that could be offered to those who were determined to reject Jesus that was going to change their minds. Now again, it would be easy for me to look at this and this dramatic unfolding of events and say, well, I'm glad I never do that. I'm glad that that's never been me. I would never do something so brazen. I would never just refuse to move even though I knew the right thing to do. And yet, rebellion doesn't always look as open and obvious as this. I can be guilty of the same attitude in a couple of ways. In a general way, I can have the same attitude of the Pharisees when I'm confronted with what God wants on any level, and I'm just not going to change. I know that I need to be pure in heart, but I like the influences in my life, and I'm not going to remove them, even if it hinders me from achieving that goal. I know that God commands me to love and support my family in Christ, and yet I may just not feel like doing it. I may refuse to take the time to get to know or to find out how I can do those things. God commands me to make disciples, and yet again I can say, well, that's not on me. That's on someone else. And so in a general way, whenever I just ignore the commands that God has given me, I'm exhibiting the same attitude. But perhaps in a more specific way, I can be like the Pharisees when I choose to elevate my thoughts, my opinions on God's will to a higher point than what He's actually said, and to do so in a way that keeps me from actually seeing the things that are true. I think it's so important for us to remind ourselves that, yes, many of these Pharisees are just openly villainous in their actions. You know, almost like the Disney cartoon villain of the wringing of the hands and the long pointed chin. They're so obvious. But that's not all of them. And most of them, if not many of them, started out with good intentions. We're going to keep people from violating the law. We're going to put barriers in place so that they won't even get close. And I need to be mindful that as I seek to try and help other people walk in the light, that I'm not imposing my own personal safeguards on other people as though they were God's law. And in a similar way, I need to be careful about the way that I approach passages. And make sure that when God has said, here's what I want you to do, here's what I want you to avoid, that's what I'm teaching. And I'm not layering on top of that, again, my own personal opinions and judgments about a passage and enforcing those as law. It's not right in the areas of organization of the church and the personal lives of Christians or any other place for me to say, I know this is what the text says, but I'm going to add something to it. And it should be very sobering to me to see here is a picture of people who started off trying to do something good, but without thought, without balancing what God's Word says, ended up so far away from actually achieving that goal. Well, the text next takes a little bit of a different direction. Now we're going to read that and talk about it, but I do think it is connected to these events, and we'll talk about that closer to the end of this section. But let's return to it in verse 12. And it was at this time that he went off to the mountain to pray, and he spent the whole night in prayer to God. And when day came, he called his disciples to him and chose 12 of them, whom he also named as apostles, Simon, whom he also named Peter, and Andrew, his brother, James and John, Philip and Bartholomew, Matthew and Thomas, James, the son of Alphaeus, and Simon, who was called the Zealot, Judas, the son of James, and Judas Iscariot, who became a traitor. Again, in verse 12, we're not given an exact time when these events took place, but Jesus' prayer and his appointing of the 12 is situated in Luke's account between two very trying times. In the confrontations of his enemies and all of this conflict escalating, it's now at the point where they are actively plotting his destruction. It's one thing to know that your enemies are eventually going to take your life. It's another thing to start to see the clock winding down. And in a way, that began when Jesus started his public ministry. There would be a period of only three and a half years for everything to be accomplished before his time came. And that day continues to draw closer, getting nearer every day that passes. I don't think we can relate in any meaningful way to the level of stress that that would bring about. And that's compounded by the continual conflict and the grief that's brought about by the hardness of heart that's being shown by his own brethren, his own people among the Jews. And so, aside from all of that, Jesus now has an important decision to make in the choosing of the 12. And so as Jesus is really pressed on all sides by these cares, he does what we would expect him to do. He goes to the mountain to pray. He finds a place to be alone and spends the entire night engaged in prayer. It cannot be said enough that we should be finding more time to pray, and that a failure to do so is a failure to prepare ourselves for the important decisions and important events that we're going to encounter. It also occurs, again, this is just what is expected of Jesus at this point. And would it not be a worthy and noble goal for it to be said in our families that prayer is just what's expected? Whenever there's a decision to be made, everyone in our family knows we're going to pray about it. We're not just going to God in times of emergency or panic, whether it's good news. Our families know we're going to pray and rejoice about it. If it's terror, if it's trial, well, of course, we're going to come together and pray about it because we are modeling the example that Jesus set for us. Spouses, children, brothers, sisters, family members, this is just what is anticipated. Prayer is going to be engaged in together. But as to the appointment of the 12, you know, sometimes we read this and it's a little confusing. We think, well, Jesus has already been spending time with his disciples. What's this about? Well, yes, the disciples has referred to a very large group of people who have followed him up to this point. But now, using that time in prayer, he's going to choose 12 out of that large group to become his closest followers, those who would be appointed as apostles, known as those who were sent out. And these men, on a higher level than those great crowds that were following him, were committing to learn, to follow him, and be a part of a special portion of his ministry. I think there are a couple of things. We've commented already, as Jesus has called some individuals, about qualities that Jesus looks for in workers. But we can point out that in the appointing of the 12, this is a relatively simple affair. Jesus did not set up a vast organization that one might think of in physical terms. He didn't have a headquarters. There was no campaign office located up in Nazareth with satellite branches and other places. There was no marketing department. There was no grand billboards that were set out. There was no board of directors. How was he supposed to get anything done without a board of directors? He just chose, very simply, 12 men who are going to be a part of the work that he had to do. At its core, Jesus' ministry was accomplished simply by his message, which was extraordinary, being spread by ordinary people. While some of these men stand out, you know, we don't really read about much following the Gospels. We don't even get personal highlights of all of the 12 in the Gospels. Some of them seem to be noteworthy, but most of these men wound up being, at least as we can read, fairly anonymous, but dedicated. In other words, it wasn't their raw talent or physical abilities that helped them to accomplish the goal that Jesus set before them. It was their level of commitment to following Christ that enabled them to be good and effective workers in the kingdom. And so as we get to this section, we might ask ourselves, how is this connected to what we've just read? And I believe that it is connected. Luke specifies and arranges it in such a way in verse 12 to emphasize that it was at that time or in those days that these events were happening that Jesus appointed the 12. I think about what's happening here. And I think about how discouraged Jesus could have been and probably was have been to bring the message. You know, we think back to chapter 4 when Jesus goes to his hometown, starts off well and ends up with them trying to throw him off a cliff. And everywhere he goes, the confrontation continues to happen. It's escalating. More and more people are rejecting as well as those accepting it. How easy would it have been for Christ to throw up his hands and say, these people don't want me. They don't want what I have. They're refusing. What clearer example of that than this, the man with his withered hand and the Pharisees responding with rage to the goodness of God. And yet, rather than despairing, rather than washing his hands of the whole situation and saying, I'm finished trying to bring it to you, verse 12 is a response that says Jesus got to work. He got busy. His response was, I'm going to appoint my 12 followers and we are going to double down in the work that we have to do. And I think that's something that is portrayed in verse 17, which we'll see in the next lesson, that immediately after this, they come down off of that mountain and they get to work. There may be other connections and other lessons that Luke intends for us to see there. But when I read Jesus appointing the 12, what I say to me is I sure am glad that Jesus did not give up because of the hard-hearted people that he had to work with. And he continued on in his ministry by appointing these 12 men. Now we're going to pause at verse 16 for this evening. But I want us to think about the lesson of what we have seen in the lives of the Pharisees. Reading these accounts should cause us to say to ourselves how terrifying it is to have a hardened heart. The longer a heart remains hardened, the more that a heart refuses the call of the Lord, the invitation of the Lord, the worse it gets. And we're seeing the development of that as we go along. The Pharisees were not nearly this antagonistic as we began, and they've got a long way to go before they hit rock bottom. The lesson that I need to bring to that, in addition to the comments we've made, is to determine that will not be me. And by way of invitation this evening, as we think about where each of us are before the Lord, for those who have not responded to the gospel as of yet, please take note of the Pharisees' example. I would hate for those who continue to postpone on that decision to have their hearts hardened to such an extent that it's a decision that they will never be willing to make. Learn the lesson from the Pharisees and soften your heart so that you can respond to the message of the gospel. And for those of us who have, again, there are so many warnings for us to take to heart. And perhaps as we spoke of them this afternoon, some of them have struck a nerve and we know that there are changes that we need to make or other needs that only you know of. Again, if we can help you, if we can encourage you in any way, we'd ask that you come while we stand and sing together.